The Bitcoin Standard Toolkit is a selection of Bitcoin services I recommend to my readers and learners on SaferDean.com as they upgrade their monetary operating system from the fiat standard to the Bitcoin standard. These companies are NYDIG, a leading full-service financial services firm dedicated to Bitcoin, applying institutional wisdom and ingenuity to help clients access the unrealized potential of this emerging asset class. NYDIG offers the full suite of solutions needed for financial institutions to access Bitcoin, including custody, execution, financing, treasury solutions, integration partnerships, and more. The team behind NYDIG brings decades of experience in the financial markets and passion for sound money to help provide the rails that will bring about a move to the Bitcoin standard. I have been working as a consultant for NYDIG for 2 years now, and I'm very impressed with their vision, focus, and execution. Go to NYDIG.com to learn more. CipherSafe. To secure your Bitcoins, it is important to keep your seed phrase backed up safely, and for that, I highly recommend using the CipherWheel Seed Storage Device, a gorgeous and brilliant sturdy piece of low-time preference engineering from a fourth-generation machine shop in Maine. The CipherWheel is machined from solid stainless steel, and its unique and elegant design is inspired by secret decoder rings, as well as legendary mechanical engineer Franz Rouleau and the golden age of machine design. If you've read the Bitcoin Standard, you'll know I think the late 19th century was a golden age for many facets of human advancement because of hard money. Bitcoin is bringing hard money back, and our friends at CipherSafe are giving Bitcoin the low-time preference machines it deserves from the golden age of design. Go to CipherSafe.io to get the CipherWheel for your Bitcoins. OKCoin. Whenever someone asks me how to invest in Bitcoin, my advice is to accumulate Bitcoins periodically for the long run, or what is called dollar cost averaging. When you buy every day, week, or month, you channel Bitcoin's volatility to your advantage. In the long run, this strategy will outperform every other Bitcoin investment strategy, probably, except for amazing luck, perhaps. The best place to do recurring purchases is OKCoin because they have the lowest fees for recurring Bitcoin purchases you will find anywhere. If you're stacking sats for the long run, every sat matters, and the fees with each purchase will add up. That's why I recommend you buy at the lowest cost possible from OKCoin. OKCoin is also the Bitcoin exchange available in the most countries around the world, so it will hopefully be accessible for you wherever you are. Go to OKCoin.com to get started with your stacking. Nodal 1. As discussed in the Bitcoin Standard, Bitcoin is controlled by the nodes that operate its software. It is only through consensus between nodes that the Bitcoin blockchain continues to live, and it is only by running a Bitcoin node that you are part of this consensus and can verify the validity of the transactions you receive and the ownership of your coins. Whenever anyone asks me what are the most important warning signs that something is wrong with Bitcoin, I always answer the following. If the number of Bitcoin nodes is declining, and or the cost of running a node is rising significantly. I believe it is really important to run a node, but I don't recommend running it on your work or personal computer as it can compromise the performance of your computer and, more importantly, the security and privacy of your Bitcoin node. A far better solution is to buy a dedicated hardware node, and for that, I highly recommend Nodal. Manage all your Bitcoin activity, such as Lightning or BTC Pay server, and isolate them from your personal computer by putting them into one dedicated device that is always running and does one thing only, Bitcoin. Become a first-class Bitcoin citizen by running your own Nodal node, available at nodal.it, and that's spelled N-O-D-L.it. Finally, Cold Card. My hardware wallet of choice is the Cold Card. I strongly recommend only conducting Bitcoin trades on computers that are dedicated to Bitcoin and cannot connect to the internet. I like the Cold Card because it is a contained machine optimized for Bitcoin.
Hopefully this will be a treat for you as it is for me. Today we have a very, very, very special guest. If you don't know yet, it's Dr. Saifedean Ammous. Thank you for coming down to Miami. I really appreciate it. Let's give a round of applause for Dr. Ammous, or Saifedean. I'm not gonna say too much about him because I know Anthony's going next, but he'll introduce him. I've been following Saifedean for the past probably 2 years, more or less, on crypto Twitter, or Bitcoin Twitter, if you will. And he's definitely impacted the way I've looked at Bitcoin and impacted the way that I've changed my view on time preferences and changed my perspective on what money was to me and what money mattered to me and the properties of money and how that would affect me and my life and also affect my family. So I'm just extremely happy to be able to bring him to my hometown where I was born and raised. I'm Andrew Bernard, I'm co-founder of BitStop. And we basically started off with bringing the first Bitcoin ATM to the state of Florida. We did that in 2015. It took us about 2 years. It was a hell of a task, but we got it done. Now we have almost about 100 nationwide between four states. So our goal is just to make Bitcoin accessible. We also We service high net worth individuals through our Bitstop private client service. So if you want to buy, you know, lots of Bitcoin or sell lots of Bitcoin, we can do that for you too. If you want to sell property for Bitcoin, we can do that also. So there's a lot of property being bought and sold for Bitcoin here in Miami, real estate capital of the world. So we'll be happy to help you out if you need these services. That being said, thank you for coming out again. I'm going to go ahead and bring up now Anthony Clavero, who's the founder of Biscayne Bitcoin, and he was actually the one that got in touch with Safety to bring him down here. So let's give it up for Anthony. And thank you for
what we really are about is mining. So, you know, the idea of mining in South Florida scares a lot of people because of the heat. And when I speak with Doug and Andrew from Bitstop, we have pride in where we're from. So for us, it's about mining in South Florida. We want to live here. We want to have our kids have a great life in Miami from their Bitcoin holdings. So, you know, for us, if you're mining in South Florida, you don't have to worry about assets in Canada or in the cold weather. So Biscayne Bitcoin is a place where, for the real Bitcoiners in here who are very familiar with mining, it's about long-term horizons for mining in South Florida. We will have products that are, you know, we'll proudly advertise in the near future for the people who want to mine down here. And then, you know, everything else just comes down to sharing knowledge, bringing people like Dr. Sykin into Miami, and just letting people kind of wake up to the new paradigm shift that hasn't really hit everybody, but is being built by the kind of people who are writing these books and educating, the people who are writing the code and developing new platforms for people to really escape hyperinflationary Venezuela, you know, Brazil, wherever you're from. So I'm proud to invite them here to Miami. Before that, I want to show hands of, like, you know, who's from Latin America and heard about Bitcoin, and this is really something that is, you know, a necessity for them. Anybody here that is like, anybody from Venezuela that's like, shit, I, you know, I'm getting wrecked in Venezuela with my Bolivar or anything like that. So he knows there's not many here, but you know, he'll discuss the value of having sound money and the like. So without further ado, Dr. Sykin.
It's great fun to be back in Miami again. I've been once before to the city and I've enjoyed it a lot, and I look forward to enjoying it more, but this time I'll hopefully make more friends than the last time. So what I'm going to do in this talk is I'm going to present some of the main ideas in my book. I'm going to try and keep the talk brief so that I just present the ideas without dwelling too much on, you know, examples and evidence for them, so that we can hopefully finish the presentation quickly, which will allow us then to have a discussion. And I find usually that having a discussion is better than talking. Is this fine? Is everybody
good?
Can everybody hear me? Okay, cool.
Perfect.
So what I'm going to talk about is why Bitcoin is different as money, what Bitcoin is good for, and what are the implications of this kind of hard money, why it matters, and three main topics that you see in front of you. So, what is it that gets used as money? In my opinion, the physical properties of things are no longer that important towards them gaining a monetary role, because, you know, we can manufacture things that can have any kind of physical property that we want today. So what matters, in my opinion, are the economic properties of things, and that's what is helps something get chosen as money. So anything can be chosen as money by people, as long as what we define money as is that it's a medium of exchange. So something that you don't buy for its own sake, it's something that you buy so that you could then exchange it for something else. That's really the technical definition of what money is. So you could do that with pretty much anything. You could buy something so that you could sell it later on to buy other things with it. But some things do that job better. Some things can do that job well, some things can do it better. So what is it that matters? In my opinion, There's a trap in my book I call the easy money trap, which is that if something gets chosen as money, if people choose to use something as a store of value, they bring the price of it up. The price of it rising causes the producers of it to try and produce more and more of it, which in turn results in the supply increasing, and that brings the price back down. So that's why most things don't work as money. If you try to put your wealth in copper if everybody, let's say in Florida, decided let's use copper as money, the price of copper would go up a lot. But then all that happens is that all of the wealth of the people of Florida will go into copper, and then copper miners will make more copper, and they'll bring the price of copper down, and they'll benefit. So effectively, copper miners will take away all the wealth of the people of Florida if they stored it in copper. And that's why people don't store their wealth in copper anymore. And you know, you could think of it both because people can understand this, or they don't even need to understand it, just simply through natural selection. People who ended up putting their money in copper over time, putting their wealth in copper, ended up watching the wealth disappear. Whereas people who put their wealth in better stores of value, like gold, for instance, they found that wealth preserved well into the future. So, what have humans used as money over time? If we look at any period in time, we find that whatever people use as money has always been hard. There's always been something that's hard to produce. If there's a mechanism to make something hard to produce more of, it's likely to get used as money. Whatever is the hardest to produce, whatever our technology allows us to make hardest to produce, ends up getting chosen as money. So cattle, rare seashells in places where they're rare, glass beads in areas that didn't have manufacture of glass, metals when metal production began, but then after metal production accelerated, only precious metals were used as money because they're hard to make and hard to find. And with government money, if we look all around the world, which are the currencies that are the most successful, that hold the most value, that are used most around the world, they're the ones whose supply increases the least. You know, the US dollar, the euro, the Swiss franc. For all of the bad things that are done with these currencies, they're still far better than the alternatives that exist in the developing world, which increase at a much faster rate. So this, if what I'm saying about money is correct, if this is really what matters, the hardness to make it, then Bitcoin is a very big deal. Why? Because Bitcoin is the hardest money ever invented. So those of you familiar might, this graph. This shows us the supply of Bitcoin, the number of Bitcoins that exist in black and across time. And then the gray line is the growth rate of the supply. So currently the growth rate is around 4%. This year the supply of Bitcoin will grow at around 4%, a little less than 4%. It started off obviously very high because we started off with a small number and then the supply was increasing quickly. But then it slows down and there's a thing called the halving, whereby every 4 years the new Bitcoins that are being produced the new daily amount of Bitcoin produced drops by half. So we're now at the point where it's 4% growth. In about 4 or 5 years, it's going to drop under 2% and then under 1.5% or so. And I think that's kind of significant because the hardest money that we had before Bitcoin was gold. And gold was hard money because gold is extremely rare to find and very expensive to find. And because it doesn't ruin, all of the stockpile of gold that we've produced over many, many thousands of years is still accumulating all over the world. So therefore, new supply is always tiny compared to the existing stockpiles. In other words, if you look at the supply of gold, every year it increases by around 1 to 2%, close to 1.5%. Almost every year in the last 60, 70 years, for which we have reliable data on gold production around the world, we see the supplies increasing at 1.52%. That's why gold is such a good store of value in the long term, right? So an ounce of gold in 1971 was worth $35. Today it's worth about $1,200. So gold holds its value much better than the dollar, obviously, because the dollar increases at around 4, 5, 6, 7% or so every year. So in a few years, Bitcoin is going to be even harder than gold to make. The supply is going to increase even less. And that, for me, is what's unique about Bitcoin. It's going to be the hardest money. Well, that's not exactly what's unique. What's unique is the fact, what's unique is the fact that Bitcoin is, not only will the supply only increase at a low amount, but more importantly, the supply is completely irresponsive to demand. And that's what's really interesting about it. So if next year 5 billion people are using Bitcoin, we will still have mining produce only 1,800 Bitcoins a day. If Bitcoin fails for whatever reason, and next year we only have 5 people using Bitcoin all over the world, there will still only be 1,800 coins. There's nothing else like that. Everything else, the quantity supplied, responds to demand, responds to price signals, except Bitcoin. Bitcoin, as many of you may have heard, does not care. It is programmed to not care about anything. So it doesn't matter how many people would buy Bitcoin, it will not respond to the supply. So with everything else, if people choose something as money, the producers of that thing will make more of it, bringing its price down in order to expropriate the wealth of the people who hold it. That applies to copper, it also applies to government money. Once a government's currency becomes widely used and popular, governments can't resist the temptation to start increasing the supply and therefore expropriating the wealth of people that hold their money and that hold their wealth in that money. Except Bitcoin. If it's chosen as a store of value, its value goes up, but more production is not possible. And that's because the difficulty of mining Bitcoin rises. Instead of the output of mining rising, the difficulty of mining rises. So what that means is not just that we don't increase the supply, which prevents the negative pressure on the price, but also, if you are not going to get into the technical details, but what this will mean is that you will have much more processing power dedicated to the production of Bitcoin, which makes the network more secure and more resistant to attack. And so this is why I like to call Bitcoin an all-conquering juggernaut, positive feedback loop of If you think about it, demand for Bitcoin as a store of value leads to the price of Bitcoin rising, which in turn makes mining become more profitable, which in turn will lead to more miners dedicating resources and electricity and processing power to Bitcoin, which is going to make Bitcoin more secure. The fact that Bitcoin becomes more secure means it resists attack, means it refuses to die, and means it continues to process transactions safely, and that attracts more people to try and put their money into it. You know, if Bitcoin was attacked several times and succeeded, it would be nowhere near, and the attacks had succeeded, Bitcoin would be nowhere near where it is today. It would be far less successful. So demand for Bitcoin grows because the network has proven its security. How secure is Bitcoin? In 9 years of operation, Bitcoin has not recorded one single fraudulent transaction. Nobody has been able to pass off one fraudulent transaction in Bitcoin because of this security model, which incentivizes security through mining and incentivizes miners to remain honest. And so the processing power that secures only 500,000 transactions per day in the case of Bitcoin, and this was, I think, a few days ago, the difficulty is adjusted now, but it's around 4 million times the world's top supercomputer, or 4 trillion times your laptop. That's how much processing power, that's how much mathematical brute force there is behind Bitcoin, which is a big deal. I mean, this is by far the biggest processing power concentration in the world. It's the biggest use of processing power in the world, because Bitcoin mining is the most profitable use of processing power at this point. So, you know, we don't really need all of this processing power to process 500,000 transactions if you wanted to have 500,000 transactions done with a single party in charge of them. You could run 500,000 transactions on your own laptop while surfing the net. But the problem with that is it's insecure. We have to trust you, and we have to trust that your laptop doesn't get attacked. So Bitcoin does that without having to rely on anybody. And so Bitcoin security results in that all that electricity consumption means that Bitcoin has no single point of failure. There's no single building, hardware, infrastructure, anything in the world that is critical for Bitcoin to operate. Bitcoin operates with whoever shows up, basically. There's no single critical individual or organization that we need to do their job honestly in order for Bitcoin to continue to exist. So if the coders that maintain Bitcoin, if let's say the 10 most prolific coders of Bitcoin were to get killed, Bitcoin is perfectly capable of continuing. None of them is vital for Bitcoin. We are all dispensable to Bitcoin and its continued survival. It basically can't be stopped. If anybody can join the network and join and be part of it, every 10 minutes a new block is broadcast to anybody who wants to join, and anybody who doesn't want to join is practically helpless, you know, in terms of stopping it. So the importance of this is that we now have the hardest money that we've ever invented as a species. That's kind of a big deal. And it's available worldwide for anyone with an internet connection, which is now, I think, the majority of the planet. It's purely voluntary. It doesn't need regulation, enforcement, or police for it to function. It functions without any of those things. And most, well, very importantly, yeah, I don't know if most, I tend to say most too many times, but very importantly, it's it fits the definition of sound money, according to the Austrian School of Economics. What we mean by sound money is that is money whose value is determined on the market by people buying and selling it free. You know, people pay for Bitcoin. Today the price is, what, $6,500? People are paying $6,500 for a Bitcoin, not because they have to. Nobody forces you to pay your taxes with Bitcoin. Nobody forces you to pay them with any specific price. Nobody puts any control on your ability to buy and sell Bitcoin at any particular price. So the price is purely determined on the free market. That's what makes sound money. Unsound money, on the other hand, is money whose value is set through coercion and not through free market exchange. So you don't have, you would have somebody putting a gun to people's head and forcing them to accept it at a specific price and forcing people to use it when they might prefer other alternative. So based on all that, what would Bitcoin be good for? Well, in my opinion, the most obvious use of Bitcoin is as a store of value. Why? Because Bitcoin is really the first strictly scarce liquid asset. With every other kind of liquid asset that we have, think of, say, oil or copper, gold, nickel, anything that you could use for exchange, anything that you know can be divisible and made into a currency, its supply is dependent on the demand. So I know we like to think that gold is scarce, that oil is scarce, that we might run out of those things, but that's not true. We're not going to run out of any of those things because the Earth's diameter is about 12,000 kilometers, and the biggest hole that we have dug anywhere in the world is about 3 kilometers deep. So we've barely scratched the surface of the Earth, and we could keep digging more and more and keep finding more and more. But of course, the limit on how much we produce of any of those things is what? It's not how much of them exists in Earth, because that's beyond our ability to even measure, let alone extract. It's simply how much time we dedicate to them as opposed to other uses of our time. So if we, you know, if for some reason, let's say nickel becomes extremely popular, somebody invents a new gadget that needs a lot of nickel, and that thing is very popular in the world, we could easily quadruple the nickel production next year if the price rises enough. The limit on it is simply how much time and effort we dedicate to it, which means we need to give up other things. So with anything else, the supply will always go up if the demand goes up. So with anything else, if you choose it as a store of value, you're always witnessing that problem, that easy money trap, which is that the producers of that thing will start making more and more of it, and thus they'll bring the value of it down. So Bitcoin is the first time in which you can actually store the value of the labor that you produce, and you can put it in a store of value that does not increase in supply. The supply does not increase, does not go up. And the only other thing whose supply is scarce for us as human beings is our time. We as human beings, we can make more gold, we can make more oil, we can make more nickel, we can make more anything. The only limit is how much time we have. Our time on this earth is finite, we will all be dead one day. And so you want your time to, you know, you want the value you produce with your time to stay with you as much as possible. And for me, this makes Bitcoin a natural, perfect match for being a store of value. Because if you think about it, the function of money as a store of value, or as a medium of exchange, is, you know, you sell your labor now today, you get $100 in return, and you want to store these $100, let's say, for next year. So how do you store it for next year? You put it in that store of value. You can think of the inflation of the supply of the store of value, the increase in the supply of the store of value, as being like the inefficiency of that machine that transfers the value into the future. And once we've invented something that's strictly scarce, whose supply will never increase, then it's effectively like we've fixed that inefficiency. We've built an engine that doesn't have that shortcoming of people being able to take the value you store in your wealth just by printing more of it, not by offering you goods and services that you value in return. Secondly, the aspect of Bitcoin which is related to the fact that it can't be confiscated, that it's very easy to hide, it's much harder to extort or steal. It's much harder to confiscate, and it's going to allow people everywhere a low-risk, low-key option to opt out of wealth confiscation and inflation. And we see this happening in places like Zimbabwe and Venezuela now. This is the sort of short-term effect of this. But in the long term, I think the important implication of this is that it's going to curtail government's ability to finance themselves through inflation. So right now, you know, governments haven't really felt, we don't have any single country where a significant enough percentage of the population has entered into Bitcoin for it to threaten the value of the currency. But it might happen. And if it happens with one country, all the others will start paying attention. You know, if Venezuela goes fully on Bitcoin over the next, say, 5 years, other countries that have inflation will start thinking twice about being inflationary. So I think it's going to force governments to move away from inflation as a method of financing the operation towards thinking about taxation instead as a method of financing that operation. And I think that's a great thing because it's much harder to tax people, honestly, before you make the spending than it is to do it with the inflation model, which is you print the money and then people get the bill later on through rising prices. So my favorite example for this is the Iraq War. If you remember in 2003, I think it was Paul Wolfowitz who went in front of the Senate and said, the Iraq War will cost $1 or $2 billion and then it'll pay for itself. He was off by a factor of 1,000. It cost between $1 or $2 trillion, which, you know, is nothing between friends, obviously. But, you know, can you imagine if Paul Wolfowitz was trying to sell the war to this US people before, in an economy in which we had hard money, in which they couldn't just print $2 trillion without anybody being able to stop them. He would have had to bring the $1 trillion from American taxpayers before any soldier set foot in Iraq. So if Americans had to pay $1 trillion in 2003 to bring democracy to Iraq, the anti-war movement would have been very, very, very different. It would have been, I think, you know, the option of fighting these sort of optional wars is completely off the table. And in my book, I look at, you know, the different the differences in the government's abilities to launch war between the 19th century and the 20th century. How much less war there was in the 19th century, how much shorter wars were, and how much more careful governments were, because if you fought a war for a stupid reason, you know, you couldn't just keep printing money and financing it. You had to collect taxes, and if you ran out of money, if you can't get taxes from people, you lost your job as king, and you know, that usually means you and your family get decapitated. So kings had to be very careful about it. And you didn't get a lot of stupid wars back then, so that's a good thing. And then the third thing which I think Bitcoin is good for is this, and this is from where the title of my book comes, is that it is a decentralized alternative to central banks and gold. If you think about, if you're trying to send money somewhere around the world today, you want to send money from Miami to China, you know, your only options are to go through central banks of the US and China. Which effectively means, for anybody in the world, you have to go through the central bank of the US. And there are only really a few currencies that allow you to do this. The US dollar, the euro, the Swiss franc, the yen, the British pound, the IMF's standard drawing rights, and gold, basically. Those are the only things that are international currencies that are available everywhere in the world. But now, we have an alternative. We have a competitor for that. And so the competitor allows us to send money around the world. You could send $1 billion to China right now, and it would clear in 40 minutes without having to go through your central bank. And that's kind of a big deal. And what we're seeing is that the way this is emerging is that, you know, what I call the Bitcoin standard, it's really not a prediction of what's going to happen, it's already what is developing. If we look at how Bitcoin is growing, how Bitcoin is scaling, we don't see an increase in the number of transactions happening on Bitcoin, but we're watching as the value of the transactions increases because second layer transactions are increasing much further more. In other words, it's beginning to look a lot like the gold standard. So if you think of how the gold standard functioned, what it did is that people didn't have to hold gold in their pockets and go and pay and move gold around every time they wanted to make a payment. The gold sat in a bank and you made a payment through the through holding the papers that were backed by the gold that the bank had. And so for every 100 or maybe 1,000 payments done with the piece of paper, wherein the paper moves, 1 ounce of gold would move between one bank and the other, or between one central bank and the other, or from one country and the other. So you can distinguish between higher layer consumer transactions, which is me buying something from you, versus settlement transaction, which is at the end of the month, my bank settles with your bank by actually moving the physical gold bar. This is what we're seeing with Bitcoin right now. Bitcoin transaction fees have risen, and as they rose, it forced exchanges and websites that use Bitcoin to start economizing on their use of Bitcoin transactions and increasing the amount of transactions that they do off-chain. So it's beginning to look a lot like the gold standard. And this, I think, is how Bitcoin is going to continue to scale, because there is a fundamental limit on how many transactions you can have on-chain. It's not clear what that number is. We know that we can do 500,000. Perhaps with some improvement, we can do 1 million, maybe two, maybe five, but still, you know, 5 million transactions is probably less than the number of transactions that take place in Miami alone. So you're not going to scale Bitcoin on a global level on chain. There's just no way that that can be done. So as this grows, what would be the effect on a society that uses this Bitcoin standard? Or maybe a better way of thinking of it is that we can think of the internet's economy as being like a new economy that now has its own central bank. So central banks now have a new competitor, which is the internet. And the internet's own central bank has its own automated monetary policy. So for people who decide to, you know, migrate to the internet economy and use that money, what would you expect the effects to be? My favorite effect, the one that I like to keep banging on about, and the reason I got interested in this topic of hard money and sound money and eventually into Bitcoin, is the issue of time preference. And time preference refers to how much you as an individual value the present compared to the future. So people who have a higher time preference are fixated much more on the present. People who have a low time preference also prefer the present, because everybody prefers the present to the future, but they prefer it less. So if I asked anybody, would you rather have, would you rather have a home today, or would you rather wait another year until I give it to you? Everybody would rather have it today. The only reason you would wait for a year is if I offered you a bigger home. Or the only reason if you wait, you would wait on a payment is if that payment meant that you would get more money for next year. So everybody has a positive time preference. In other words, everybody prefers current consumption over future consumption for the simple reason that you might die in the future and then you don't get to consume the stuff. So my theory is that easy money, money that's easy to produce, encourages people to think much more of the short term and to consume, because the money's not going to hold its value, so why would you want to hold wealth into the future if it's going to lose its value? Hard money, on the other hand, will increase in value over time, and so it will encourage people to spend less and instead accumulate capital and increase their savings. So another way of thinking of this, of course, is through the interest rate, which is the price of money. So when the interest rate is artificially manipulated downward, then that just makes borrowing cheaper and makes saving less rewarding. And so people start saving less and they start borrowing more. So one common objection to Bitcoin we keep hearing is related to this, is the idea that, well, if, and this is what Keynesian economists would tell you, if we had a money like Bitcoin whose value increases over time, people would stop spending, because why would you spend your money today when you can, when it'll have a bigger value tomorrow, right? Well, wrong, because you need to survive. You still need to wear clothes, you need to eat food, and you need to live in a house. In other words, time preference is always positive. You still need to eat this year. So if I told you the $100 in your pocket will be worth $500 next year, you're not going to starve yourself for a whole year so that next year you'll be able to eat more, right? You're going to eat what you need so that you survive. So in other words, a money that increases in value does not cause people to stop spending, as the Keynesian economists scare us. It causes people to stop spending on stupid nonsense that they don't need. But they still will spend on essential things. So the effect that's going to have on people is that people will start spending less and accumulating capital more and thinking more of the future. How do we know this? Well, we can look at savings rate over the last 50 years in Western economies as they moved away from using gold as money and moved towards highly depreciating, quickly depreciating money. We see savings rate go down quickly everywhere. And the only country that maintains a semblance of high savings rate is Switzerland, because it was the last one to leave the gold standard. So low time preference is really, it's what starts the process of civilization, because it allows people to stop thinking of the present and start investing in the future. You know, the first human, what distinguishes us as human beings from animals is the ability to think of the future and to delay gratification. What differentiated us from other monkeys is that we started building tools and building durable goods that we would use into the future. So a human was able to think, you know, I could go and catch, say, 3 rabbits today, or I can catch 2 rabbits and then spend the time that I would have spent catching a third one on developing a rabbit trap or on developing a spear or things like that. Once you've developed that as a capital good, it increases your productivity over time. And so it leads to higher productivity, more production, and better material living standards. So this is important economically, but I think it also has consequences that go beyond just economics, because once people are able to get into this productive stage where their wealth increases over time, they're able to accumulate capital and they're continuously increasing their production, people are free from the drudgery of just continuously needing to guarantee their survival and having to work and think only of the short term, day-to-day survival. And once people are freed from that, that's when people flourish. That's when human beings, in my opinion, flourish. And I think, I give a lot of examples about this in the book, but my favorite one to distinguish the difference is art, because it really tells a very good story. So this is, on the left is the Sistine Chapel in Italy, drawn by Michelangelo. Now, on the right is something called, I don't know what it's called, it's a painting by a guy called Mark Rothko, which he drew, I presume, in 20 minutes or something like that. it's actually quite interesting. You know, most people don't ask themselves this question, but why is it that, you know, 400 years ago, 500 years ago, we were this species of monkey that was able to produce things like that, and now nobody produces anything like that? We don't see any Sistine Chapels being built anywhere in the 20th century. And instead, what the people that we call artists are just giving us, you know, wallpaper and telling us stories about why it's important. Why do we not see that? Well, in my book, I quote a poem that Michelangelo wrote about how he drew the Sistine Chapel. And he spent 4 years hanging from the ceiling. He got sick, he got many illnesses. You know, I presume he didn't have much of a social life hanging from there. It's important innovations that we have came from that era, and really what we've been doing in the 20th century is just improving on all of these things, but not really inventing much that is new, and perhaps there's a problem with that. Secondly, I think the second impact of this is that it's going to cause a reduction in the role of government, because if you think about it, you know, more and more of our economic production in the modern information economy is just information. It's not physical anymore, it's digital. It's just zeros and ones. You know, if you're a graphic designer, if you're a website producer, if you're an artist, if you're a writer, more and more and more of our economic activity is becoming digital, informational, and the importance of physical production is declining. So 200, 300 years ago, having physical infrastructure was what meant, was real economic production. So, with physical infrastructure, physical capital being important, governments, you know, with their monopoly on force, they could use their force to appropriate that capital, or at least force their owners to pay taxes. But when the capital is in your mind, when the capital is just simply knowledge that is in your mind, it's much harder to confiscate, and it's much harder to get to work. You know, if you take a graphic designer and put a gun to their head and tell them to design a website, it's very hard to get them to work as productively as if they're working for themselves. And most importantly, it's very easy for the graphic designer to leave with their capital. It's not easy for the factory owner to leave with their factory. So effectively, government's territorial monopoly was starting to count for less and less. And governments, instead of, you know, expropriating their people and raising taxes, will have to start competing for people and lowering taxes rather than increasing them. And Bitcoin really fixes this, because more of the economy was digital, but the way that governments have maintained their ability, their stranglehold on economies, is because even though the activity itself may be information, you still have to pay with it through the physical infrastructure of the banking system. So now that the money and the goods and the capital are all informational, it's going to be a big problem for government. So what I think we'll see from this is more and more of the world becoming like Switzerland, You know, Switzerland is a place where, anybody know the name of the president of Switzerland? Nope, I asked the same question in Switzerland, most people don't know. Everybody knows the name of the president of Venezuela, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so who has the better deal, Venezuela or Switzerland?
Switzerland.
Yeah, or North Korea. Generally, the more well-known the president of a country is, the worse the country is. Because the more important the president is, the more the government controls parts of your life, and the worse life is. In Switzerland, nobody needs to know who the president is, because the president cuts a few ribbons every couple of weeks, and that's about it. He can't affect your life, he can't do anything to you. And I think more and more we're going to see this kind of transformation. Finally, this is a little bit complicated economics. If interested in reading about this, read chapters 7 and 8 in my book. But effectively, today, you know, we are taught at university, and I teach my unfortunate undergraduate students, that, you know, recessions and inflation are just a normal part of capitalism. It's just, you know, just like there's rain in the weather, sometimes you get recessions. And, you know, that's one way of looking at it, but there are other ways of looking at it, correct, grown-up, mature ways of looking at it, called the Austrian School of Economics. And according to the Austrian School of Economics, recessions are simply the result of economic interest rate manipulation by central banks. It's a very complicated theory, which I'm not going to explain in detail here, but doing research on it, I found this story, this graph that shows Switzerland's unemployment rate under three different monetary regimes. So leading up to the mid-1970s, Switzerland was still on a gold standard. And as you can see, the unemployment rate rarely ever went up over 0.1%. As soon as they go off the gold standard, we get back to all of those recessions and they start getting unemployment rising around 1% or so. And then in 1990 is when the Swiss franc stopped being backed enormously by gold, and they sold about half of their gold reserves, and so the Swiss franc became more and more like regular currencies, and as a result, now Switzerland gets to enjoy the wonders of Keynesian inflation and funny money, and they get to start teaching their kids that this is just the normal way in which life works, that, you know, it's normal that we're always going to have 5 or 6 or 7% unemployment. It isn't. It doesn't have to be. So, I think this ability to move towards a hard money that governments can't manipulate is going to have enormously beneficial economic impacts. And the ability of us to just go back to having one neutral global money, I think, is an enormously important thing. Because in the 20th century, one of the worst things that has happened in the 20th century is that we uninvented one of the most important technologies that we came up with in the 19th century, which is the gold standard, which allowed the whole planet to work with one money, which was amazing because, you know, you could be trading with people from all over the world, and exchanges between different currencies were simply like exchanges between inches and meters. There was the British pound was a certain amount of gold, the French franc was a certain amount of gold, and exchanging them for one another was not an FX market. It was more like converting inches to meters. So now we've uninvented that, and we give each little patch of land its own currency. And so now if you want to buy something from Canada, you can't just buy that thing. You have to go back to a system of barter, where you buy the currency of Canada first, and then you have to buy it. And so businesses today, you know, maybe for many businesses, for instance, when foreign exchange shocks happen, like in Brexit in Britain, you could be working for 20 years on developing your advantage in something, and then that shock happens in a country that you export from or import from or whatever, and then all of your business model is blown out of the water. That's it, it's gone. Not through any fault of your own, just simply because the things that you're using as a calculation unit are not stable and they're constantly changing. So this, I think, would be a great addition of what Bitcoin could offer to the world. And finally, you know, it would allow us to have monetary policy to be automated, so free from human intervention and control. And we go back to a system where we have a free market in money, in savings, capital, and investments. And if you see, you know, free markets work much better. I think it's pretty clear in pretty much anything. If we had free markets in those days, I think people are going to be astonished at how much better life can be and how much more productive economic activity can be. That's it for me. That's the book. And if you want to contact me, this is my information. Thank you very much.
question, let you guys think of some questions, right? Everybody's got to get some ideas in their head, just throw it at them. We already have one. All right, so I'm going to ask a question.
I'll preface this by saying, you know, I was initially a skeptic.
Okay.
I'm not an investor. My brother has convinced me of the rationalities behind the theory. Everything you espoused upon regarding supply, regarding the difficulties surrounding manipulation, fraudulent conveyance, it all sounds very sound. The concern I have is demand is often irrational. We see it with the fluctuations in the value of Bitcoin today versus 3 months ago. So what do you see as those current disruptors, and have we
anticipated? All right, guys, do you want to enjoy some more refreshments before they're all gone? Go ahead and get it.
Probably for a while, because you know Bitcoin is now a tiny little drop in the ocean of money in the world. So the value of all the Bitcoins out there are like 0.1% of the entire value of all the other monies. So you know, if one person decides to sell $10 million and buy Bitcoin with it, that will have a significant impact on the price. If they decide to sell Bitcoin, that will also have a significant impact. So I don't believe that you can really identify short-term trends, because you know all it takes is one billionaire somewhere buying or selling, and then it causes big variation. But you can see the long-term driver of the trend is just that the new supply is continuously increasing, which means that if the demand, you know, Bitcoin's demand doesn't need to grow for it to increase in value. Bitcoin's demand, I calculated this the other day, if Bitcoin's demand drops by 15% every year, meaning every year 15% fewer people want Bitcoin, fewer new people want Bitcoin, Bitcoin would still go up in value. Why? Because every 4 years the new supply drops by half. So you just need to not drop the new supply by more than half in 4 years, and that will cause the price to increase. So the way that I see it is, there's really no escaping this just simple supply and demand, and people are going to recognize it. It's playing out because, you know, if people see that the price is rising, that's going to increase demand more, which is going to cause the price to rise even more and more. So I think that's really going to be the long run driver of it. But in the short run, no, expect a lot of volatility, which is why, you know, I'm not trying to tell you to invest in Bitcoin. I don't think Bitcoin needs evangelizing, and I don't advise people to put a lot of money in Bitcoin. You know, if you bought in December, you'd be down 70% now. So, you know, it would be wrong to go in all at once, put in a significant amount. I would say, you know, go in at a small amount and time your purchases and make sure that you know what you're doing. The most important thing, of course, is to know how to use it and know how to use it safely. That's the most important investment you can do. But in the long run, I think, you know, I'm not trying to get you to buy, but I'm just identifying this economic trend. I think, you know, we could have bear markets that last maybe 5 years, but, you know, in the very long run, I can't see this reversing. Yes. Thank you.
Yes.
So why Bitcoin over any other cryptocurrency?
Yes. Good question, which I always hate answering. Because somebody's going to get upset and then we're going to have to argue about it all night. But I'm going to answer briefly. The only reason I think Bitcoin matters is that the money supply can't be changed. Okay, so if somebody could control Bitcoin, if we found out tomorrow that somebody has the ability to change the supply of Bitcoin, you know, throw my book away, forget you've ever heard of me, and you know, I would forget about Bitcoin completely. It's... Yeah, what's interesting about it is that it's something that doesn't require you to trust in anybody. Unlike government money, which, you know, you have to vote for the right people and hope that they appoint the right people and that they all, you know, don't collude with one another for the money supply not to increase too much, and then it never really works. We've tried the experience of having humans run money, and, you know, I have a whole chapter about it in my book, and I think it's failed miserably. So we have this now option of having money being completely autonomously determined, automated. Nobody can control it. And that's what really makes it valuable. You know that there will only ever be 21 million Bitcoins. So you're buying 21 Bitcoins, let's say today, you know you've got a millionth of all the Bitcoins that will ever exist today and 100 years from now, 500 years from now. That's the real value proposition in my mind. None of the other currencies have that. And the reason is, Bitcoin, the person who invented it, is completely different from all the people who are inventing all the other currencies. Not because he's an angel or anything, but quite simply because he was the person who thinks like an engineer. He invented something new, and then that was it, and it was introduced. All the good engineers since then are working on building things on Bitcoin. So when the wheel was invented, you know, the good engineers didn't try and think, okay, let me make my own wheel, maybe with a triangle, or maybe let me invent a wheel with a square. The smart engineers started thinking, okay, we have a wheel, what can we do with it? Let's build something on top of it. That's where all the smart developers have gone. And that's why all, you know, people talk about all the innovation in the crypto space. There's no innovation in the crypto space. All the innovation happens from Bitcoin coders. All the other coins copy the code from Bitcoin, add a bunch of pointless bells and whistles. But the point behind all these other coins is to enrich the people who made them. That's why they're different. Because if those people were interested in the technology or in inventing something new, they'd be building on Bitcoin, not trying to produce another thing, and not putting themselves in front as the owners of it. And that's what all these coins have. So you know, there are more than 1,600 coins out there. If anybody here has heard of any one of these coins, the only reason you heard of it is because somebody is out there promoting it. So there's a foundation, there's a group of people. There are people who do this serially. You know, they do one coin and then they move on to the other and then to the other. So, you know, for me to be able to say that Bitcoin is really 21 million, it's not something that, you know, it's not an app that you just download. Okay, 21, you can always change the code. Why can't Bitcoin change? We've seen over 7, 8, 9 years of how hard it has been for people to change Bitcoin. We've seen how many people have quit and gone completely insane because they failed to get their vision of how Bitcoin is going. And it's a beautiful thing to watch because, you know, all of these influential people who think, you know, they get rich because they buy it early and then they think, okay, we can change it because we know better because we're rich, and it doesn't work. Bitcoin continues and nothing they do. So last year, what really drove this point home for me was last year when, you know, 90% of the miners, most of the companies that work in Bitcoin, they all got together and they decided, all right, we're just going to change not the money supply, just the size of the block. You know, we're just going to make Bitcoin handle double the transactions. And what happened? They couldn't do it. They invented another altcoin, which is, of course, completely pointless because they control it. So what's the point of having a currency that they control? So none of them will have that. And, you know, well, you could say, okay, well, they won't be money, maybe they'll do something else. If they're going to do something else, and they are centralized, they don't need Bitcoin's structure. They don't need to have their own token. They don't need any of this electricity burning. They don't need any of this massive cost. They still are centralized. So the example that I like to give is that, you know, if you still have a centralized party controlling it, like all these other altcoins have, you know, the Ethereum Foundation or the EOS Foundation, all those people, if you have somebody controlling it, then effectively it's like taking a horse carriage and adding an engine onto the horse and thinking that that's going to make it faster. You know, the point of the engine is to replace the horse. The point of the blockchain and all this structure is to not have a third party. So if you have a third party and still having this extremely cumbersome structure to make the thing work, there's no other word for it. It's just
a Rube Goldberg machine.
Exactly, it's a Rube Goldberg machine. It's cargo cult engineering. It's you copy the rituals of other engineers without understanding why they're doing them, and you know the results are predictably hilarious. So I don't really see any of those coins mattering in any way. And I've spent a lot of time. Far too much time reading far too many of them. Yes.
Just a quick question. Read your book. Really, really liked it a lot. I think it's just a great book for even somebody like I could get my mother or my father, and you know, they don't have to be like a 24/7 crypto trader to kind of get the main takeaways from that book. I'm just curious. I know you're in the Bitcoin standard mode still, and you're on tour and so forth. If you were to write a second book, what do you find most interesting now? What would you like to write about in the future? You know, with another book, what do you find cool and interesting about the Bitcoin space? You know, that you would like to maybe write a little bit more about and dive a little deeper on.
I mean, a few more ideas are beginning to percolate, but it's still a little too early to discuss them. So volatility is one, and how it's going to evolve over time. And I think discussing banking and credit arrangements and whether they can work on Bitcoin, can they work, will they work, is it workable or not, I think this is going to be an interesting thing. But it's still early days, because with Bitcoin's current appreciation and the volatility, I don't think it's going to be used in banking and borrowing and lending quite soon. But at least theoretically, I think that would be something interesting worth looking into. But my next book is not going to be specifically about Bitcoin. I'm planning on writing a Bitcoin textbook. So tell all your college student friends to prepare themselves to buy in a couple of years. Yes, goodbye.
Do you see it as a problem that China is able to mine a lot of the Bitcoin? And if you do see it as a problem, you have a solution?
No, I don't really see it as a problem. And it's already solving itself now. The way it solves itself is that the price goes up, and so all mining manufacturers around the world are beginning to pay attention to Bitcoin. So now Korean and Japanese manufacturers are beginning to manufacture mining equipment, and that's going to reduce the monopoly that China has. But I don't really think it's a problem, because, and this is also a very valuable lesson we learned from the story that I was mentioning in 2017, miners don't control Bitcoin. Miners are the, you can think of them as the slave labor of Bitcoin. So, a good way of explaining it is, imagine people who worry about the miners taking over Bitcoin is a little bit like worrying about the janitors taking over the White House, because they're the White House, you see? So yes, you know, the janitors, if they decide to stop working and they stop cleaning the White House, it'll be a problem, right? The White House will be dirty, the president won't be able to do his job, and you know, maybe the janitors can then launch a coup and take it over. Right? No, because if you're a janitor and you're in the White House and you make any sort of thing that is not required of you in the job, you get fired and somebody else is hired. The world is full of people who want to work if you pay them. And so since this is a valuable service, the White House is willing to pay, people are going to be coming. So you as an employee are completely dispensable to the operation of the White House. And so, you know, just because you're close to the power, just because you're working in it, doesn't mean that you have a say. So miners, they simply get paid to write the transactions, and they, you know, they get paid after they've spent an enormous amount of resources on solving the proof of work. And that's how Bitcoin maintains its honesty. So as a miner, in order to ensure that you don't lie as a miner, we force you to spend electricity roughly equal to the value of the block reward, which is about $80,000 per block. So every 10 minutes, miners are spending around $80,000 in order to solve the proof of work and get to be the one who writes the transaction, and then get the reward that's worth around $80,000. It varies, obviously, but you know, roughly it moves around the same number. So essentially, if miners decide to change the rules, then all that happens is they spend their $80,000, and then the network looks and says, oh, they have different rules, and so we're not going to give them the $80,000. So miners have no ability to mess with the network, because they've invested an enormous amount of capital, and they control a lot of, then they spend a lot of electricity. And you know, if they try to change the rules, all that happens is they burn their own capital and their own money to waste. Every 10 minutes, they blow $80,000 down the drain, and that's it. That's all that will happen. So the profitability of mining is what ensures the honesty of miners. And so it's not, I am simplifying it. Of course, there are more complicated attack vectors. Mining centralization is more of a problem than I'm making it out to be, not because of the miners themselves, but because maybe governments could take over the mining and do things. But it's still very far-fetched, and the solution to it is simply, as the price rises, mining becomes so much more of a distributed capital intensive industry that, you know, people who have invested hundreds of millions of dollars can't afford to play around with ideas, notions of let's make Bitcoin better in this way or the other. They just want to get their capital back.
Would you say that's why that you're seeing mining companies starting to go public, especially on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange, just to go ahead and list now and, you know, suck what equity capital out of equity markets that they can before it becomes
exactly. Monetized
as it will be?
Yeah, and I think it's likely to just continue to grow. I mean, Bitcoin mining is just likely to continue to grow as an industry. And,
yeah.
You know, they'll be listed and they'll have more and more capital, and that's just going to make it more and more serious. Know, and more distributed and decentralized. Yes?
So with regard to rules that miners follow, could you speak a little bit about what kind of governance applies to
Well, that's a very complicated question, but you know, a short answer is it doesn't. Well, they do change. But essentially, the thing is, the thing about Bitcoin is this. You can make any change in the way that your node interacts with the network as long as you stick to the broad rules of consensus, which, you know, if you break these, then you get off the network. So for instance, if you decide that you want to make the size of the block bigger, or if you increase the block reward, or if you you know, start confirming transactions that are not valid, all these things, if you do them, then you're no longer in the network. That's it, okay? So if you wanted to make one of these changes, the way that it works in Bitcoin is that, you know, if say 20% of everybody in Bitcoin decided that they want to do it, then 20% end up with their own currency and Bitcoin ends up on its own with the 80%. If 99% wanted to move to a new currency, the 1% will remain. Which is why effectively, you know, changing Bitcoin is, it's not impossible, it's almost impossible. And the reason is that if two people want to continue to run their nodes by the current protocol rules, those two people will continue to run Bitcoin as it is, and there's nothing you can do about it. You can't stop people around the world from continuing to do this. Now, ideologically, you know, what drew the people who use Bitcoin into Bitcoin, not all of them obviously, but a lot of the sort of motivated ideologically, ideologically motivated Bitcoiners, they are precisely in it because it's stable and the rules are fixed. So, you know, on top of the fact that there's a very strong status quo bias in the rules of the network, there's a very strong status quo bias within the individuals who take part in the network. So that's why the changes are extremely hard. That's, I think, I would say the best way I could answer this question. Yes?
So there's two main, there's kind of two main arguments where Bitcoin is either a source of sound money or it's medium, or it's a medium of exchange. Mm-hmm. I think it's either both or it's none. But you compare Bitcoin to gold. So if it is gold, and I actually got this question this morning. If it is gold, we're focusing on layer 2 protocols, right? Mm-hmm. So would you be willing to expend gold for traditional micropayments or for things that would facilitate a regular transfer of value? Would that make sense if it actually is gold or is better than gold? How does that work?
So the way that it works, I think most Bitcoiners like me have rarely ever spent any of their Bitcoin. I have no reason to ever spend my Bitcoin as long as people are giving me the great pleasure of taking my dollars instead. So, you know, as long as you have the two, you're likely to hold on to the one that appreciates more into the future and spend the one that depreciates. And that has worked out very well for anybody who's tried it over the last 5 years. And the fact that it's worked out really well is why don't think that you can't, you know, there's no free lunch. Eventually people are going to wise up, they're going to want in on this, and they're going to stop accepting the inferior monies. And there will come a tipping point at which, you know, when you want to buy something, people won't accept your other money. So yeah, I'd like to keep my Bitcoins as long as possible, but I recognize that eventually it'll be difficult because, you know, I mean, some people are already developing the ability to say no to getting paid with other currencies. If you're already you can afford to just say, no, I don't want to get paid in dollars, pay me only in Bitcoin. But I think that's going to likely begin to increase more and more over time. And then, you know, you'll be spending it because you have to, because, you know, you want to survive. So even though your time preference is, lower, it's still not zero. You still need to eat. And, you know, the point of money is to spend it. Okay, so we have time for one more question. This is the back of the meeting.
Considering Bitcoin's
The good thing about it is that, you know, energy production is not really something that has a switch somewhere where, you know, say some evil guy could just flick it and then electricity goes off in the world. Anybody can produce electricity through any kind of technology. So, you know, you can't turn off all sources of energy in the world. You can't. There's no master switch for all the engines in the planet. And so it's not like we're going to have a point where one day we just have complete darkness. If we do, we have far bigger problems than whether Bitcoin survives or not. All of our civilization will basically be collapsing in that case. So, you know, it's not, I don't think it's a problem in terms of grid failure. It's also not really an issue in terms of regulation.